Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School at Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on oxymorons when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, well, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps has to be incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that if a lawyer, you know, a guy that goes to college, he becomes a lawyer can't represent himself in court, he has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. He says worse than that. He said, most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Now, in our school, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Hey, we were talking about oxymorons last time, and oxymoron is a word in the dictionary. I looked it up, and I thought it was just a funny story. You know, some guy comes up with a funny story like military intelligence or cruel kindness or something like that. And it's kind of insane, you know, when you make these kind of crazy statements. And I got to thinking about oxymorons. You know, they're more common than you might ordinarily believe. And we seem to just pick right up on them, like drunk drivers kill. So last time I took the subject of drunk drivers kill, and I said, well, I think that's an oxymoron. And I thought I'd take up another one over here, like, you know, if you don't get a college education, if you don't get your high school diploma, can you remember those words? And somebody, it was your Aunt Bessie or your mom or dad or somebody, you know, that said, if you don't get your college education, you're going to be a failure in life. You're not going to be able to get a job. You won't be able to function in the real world. And so I look at this thing, oxymoron, and it's the opposite to common sense. Oxy is a word that means sharp, and it's combined with the word moros, meaning foolish. It's a combination for epigrammic effect of contradictory or incongruous words, such as cruel kindness. He has a kind of cruel kindness about him. You know, that's kind of crazy on its face. You can't have cruel kindness, can you? Okay, so I took a look at that as it relates to education. And I said, you know, when I was a kid, I was encouraged all through school. I mean, we didn't start in the first grade. I can't think of Mrs. Sorensen doing this. But by the time it was third grade time, Mrs. Wiles was telling us how important our education was and how, you know, the better you do in school, the easier it will be for you to get into college. And that's why during grammar school and middle school and high school, you want to do your very best so that you can get the best possible grades and the best possible job so that you can get into college. Now, keep in mind that all of the people who are telling you this are all college graduates. You know, it's kind of like religious people, you know, telling you to believe in Jesus and Christmas and Easter and New Year's. You know, these people all have an axe to grind. These people all have something that they're selling. Now, it makes all the sense in the world for a college administrator to be talking about college and talking up how good it is and how their college graduates all get jobs and prestigious employments and they make tons and tons of money and marry beautiful girls and have beautiful children and live the life of Riley. And that just makes all the sense in the world because that's what you're selling. You know, the Cadillac salesman, he tells you how good Cadillac automobiles are. Now, not everybody buys a Cadillac automobile. You know, some of us ride bicycles. Some of us ride horses. And not everybody, in my view, is college material. And I want to be the first to tell you that little Georgie Gordon never was college material. I was never interested in college. I was never interested in public school. I went to public school. I ran away in the first grade, second grade, third grade. Fourth grade, fifth grade. I don't think I stopped running away from school until I was, oh shucks, probably ninth grade. And by then it wasn't running away, it was called cutting class. You know, so, and I did plenty of that too. So I really wasn't all that interested in school. And I got to looking around and I thought, well, I wonder if there's anybody else like me. You know, anybody else out there that didn't like school, didn't go to school, didn't go to college, and have they succeeded? And one of the guys that I got to thinking about was Bill Gates. Bill Gates is a, you know, he made a couple of bucks, and he runs a company called Microsoft. And he went to college for a while. His daddy's a lawyer. His daddy's college educated. And he, you know, I guess his daddy said, no, Bill, if you don't go to college, you're going to end up being a failure in life. So Bill Gates, he went to college, and then he got bored with it, and he went out and he did something with his life, and he made it $2 or $3, and now he's running this company called Microsoft. He's called the richest man in the world. Last time I heard, he had $37 billion, which is a real really taken in the shorts, because he had 67 before the collapse of the stock market in 2007. But he's made a couple of bucks back. Last time I heard, he had $37 billion. And then the second richest guy's name is Warren Buffett. I don't know where he went to school or where he went to college, but he's number two, and he's only got $30 billion. So I started looking around, and did you know that John Adams, you ever heard of John Adams? He's the second president of the United States. Did you know he didn't go to college? I just thought I'd point that out to you. A guy by the name of Joseph Pulitzer, he was homeschooled. He was a failure in life, too. And a guy by the name of Ansel Adams. You ever heard of Ansel Adams? I forgot who he was now. I think he was a writer or a painter or something. He's kind of famous, Ansel Adams. And he seemed to make a living for himself without going to school. And then there's Robert Frost. I've heard of him. Irving Berlin. He's a music writer. He was homeschooled. Whoopi Goldberg. Have you ever heard that name, Whoopi Goldberg? Did you know she was homeschooled? Yeah, she didn't get a high school diploma. Then there's Jennifer Love Hewitt, the Hanson singers. William F. Buckley. William F. Buckley. He puts out a conservative paper. He calls himself a conservative. I think he's a radical lib. But anyway, he uses big words. If you've ever seen him on TV, he uses words that nobody else has ever heard, can't pronounce, can't say, don't know what they mean. That's him. William F. Buckley, Jr. Then a guy by the name of Jason Taylor of the NFL. I don't know who he is, but I guess he's a football player. Then there's Todd Lodwick. Never heard of him. But Andrew Carnegie, I heard of him. Andrew Carnegie, homeschooled. Charlie Chaplin, he's a movie actor and director. Agatha Christie, she was a writer. Winston Churchill. Did you know that Winston Churchill was a failure in life? Didn't go to public school. Didn't get a high school diploma. Didn't go to college. Homeschooled. Charles Dickens, same. Thomas Edison. This guy Edison had 1,200 patents. Did you know that? 1,200 patents to his name. Only went to the third grade. You ever heard of a guy named Henry Ford? He was another failure in life. He was educated, but he was only educated to the sixth grade. I'll tell you a story about old Henry over there. He's a pretty funny guy. But anyway, Benjamin Franklin and Florence Nightingale, Woodrow Wilson, he was president of the United States during World War I. He was elected in 1914. He was elected in 1912. In 1914, the war started, you know. Then from 12 to 16, he said he kept us out of war, and then he got us involved in the war because we were missing out on all the profits, and so he fixed his mistake. The Wright brothers, you ever heard of the Wright brothers, guys that invented the airplane? Did you know that they never had a degree in aeronautical engineering? Of course, they never built a 747 either, and I'm not really sure that you could build a 747 without an aeronautical engineering degree, you know, without some brains behind it. So I'm not against going to college. I mean, if you want to be an aeronautical engineer, that's probably a good profession, probably a good trade. Franklin D. Roosevelt, he was president of the United States. The only thing old FDR did that I agreed with was repealing prohibition. God bless old FDR for putting booze back on the counter. Alexander Graham Bell invented a telephone. Pearl Buck, she was a writer. These people now are all homeschooled. General George S. Patton, do you know that guy was a fool? I mean, he was educated in West Point, but he was homeschooled. And he was a success without a high school diploma. You know, I just want to point that out, that just because you didn't get a high school diploma didn't mean that you couldn't go to college. A lot of people believe without a high school diploma, you can't go to college. It's kind of like if you don't pass from the fourth grade to the fifth, you can't go to the fifth grade. That's not so. That's not true. Joan of Arc, she was kind of famous. Old-timey lady, Joan of Arc, she was. Leonardo da Vinci, he was a pretty good painter, you know, and he didn't go to college or high school. He was homeschooled. Leonardo da Vinci. Wolfgang Mozart, homeschooled. Felix Mendelssohn, I think he was also a composer. Claude Monet, I don't know who he was. Sounds kind of Frenchy to me. William Penn, you know, he was pretty famous Pennsylvanian, William Penn. Abraham Lincoln, 16th president. Theodore Roosevelt, Robert E. Lee, General Douglas MacArthur, all homeschooled. No high school diplomas. C.S. Lewis, Hans Christian Andersen, Mark Twain. Mark Twain. My God, Mark Twain. You mean he didn't go to journalism school to learn how to write? Seemed to get by all right. George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. Remember old John Adams? I mean, Patrick Henry, John Paul Jones. All of these famous founding fathers of our nation never went to college, never went to high school, homeschooled. And yet somehow or another, these people were all educated. You know that? I'm not suggesting that you ought to grow up stupid, ignorant, fools. But what I am suggesting is that it's an oxymoron for you to believe that you have to go to high school, you have to go to public school, you have to go to college to learn something. Boys and girls, some of the most successful people in the history of the world have never gone and never experienced a formal public education. The concept that you're going to be a failure in life if you don't go to college, I think, is an oxymoron. If you don't get your high school diploma, you're going to fail in life. I don't think that's true. Henry Ford didn't fail in life. He didn't have a high school diploma. Now, it's firmly taught, and it's universally believed, at least here in the United States, that that's the case. Here's the story of Ansel Adams. He's arguably the greatest photographer of the 20th century. I said I thought he was a painter or something, you know, artist. He was a photographer at 12, unable to stand the confinement and tedium of the classroom. He utterly disrupted his lessons with wild laughter and undisguised contempt for the inept ramblings of his teachers. Have you ever listened to the inept ramblings of your teachers or professors? So his father decided that Ansel's formal education was best ended. And from that point forward, the boy was homeschooled in Greek and English classes, algebra, and the glories of the ocean, inlets, and rocky beaches that surrounded their home very near San Francisco. John Adams, second president of the United States, was taught to read at home and then happily went for lessons with a handful of other children, taught in the kitchen of a neighbor lady who was considered fitted for college, and proceeded to Harvard at age 15. So here's John Adams. He went to college, but he was homeschooled, didn't have that famous high school diploma. And there's quite a story of notable people. If I have time in this program, I'll give you some more. But I wanted to tell you a couple of stories over here about homeschooled people and some of the famous names that go along with these people who have been homeschooled. Now, we tend to think of people as being educated. When you hear names like John Jay, Patrick Henry, John Marshall, Roger Taney, Abraham Lincoln, Clarence Darrow. You ever heard of Clarence Darrow? Well, let me read you a list of names of 12 of our nation's most prominent lawyers in the field of law, you know, where we are here at this law school. I'm in the field of law. I'm a law school teacher. I'm immersed in law, and I teach it, and I believe it, and I use it, and I understand a little bit of it. And I'm kind of interested in lawyers, and so when I read about Patrick Henry, I knew he was an attorney, and then John Jay and John Marshall and William Wirch, you know. And so I'm always interested in lawyers. You know, it's kind of like trade secrets. You know, if you're a doctor, you're kind of interested in, you know, the famous doctors that did the first brain transplant, you know, or something like that. So you're about to read the names of 12 of our nation's most prominent lawyers. One of these men was a law school dropout. Let's see if we can guess the name of the law school dropout, shall we? One of these guys dropped out of law school. Now listen to these stories. Patrick Henry passed his oral bar examinations in 1760, and within 3 years, Patrick Henry had handled more than 1,100 cases. He was a member of the Continental Congress, and he was later governor of Virginia. Does he sound like a law school dropout to you? John Jay. He was admitted to the bar in 1768 and subsequently distinguished himself as the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. John Jay, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Does he sound like a law school dropout to you? John Marshall passed his bar exams in 1780. He later became a Supreme Court Chief Justice. Surely a Chief Justice would not be a law school dropout. William Wirt was barely 20 when he practiced law in Culpeper County, Virginia, and he eventually became United States Attorney General. Surely an Attorney General of the United States would not be a law school dropout, no, would he? Roger Taney was admitted to practice in 1799. He served as first Secretary of the Treasury, then as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Oh my God, we've got John Jay, John Marshall, Roger Taney, three Chief Justices of the Supreme Court. We wouldn't consider any of those chief justices as being law school dropouts, would we? Daniel Webster, remember Webster's Dictionary? Well, Daniel Webster was admitted to the Boston Bar in 1805 and established a phenomenal legal reputation, and he also served as Secretary of State in 1841. God, he was as high as Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. Daniel Webster, was he a law school dropout? Salmon P. Chase gained his early prominence as a defense attorney for runaway slaves and also later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Now we have four chief justices here of the Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln, he gained his experience as a lawyer and became the 16th president of the United States. Can you become president of the United States if you're a law school dropout? Stephen Douglas was admitted to the bar in 1834. Douglas later became a representative, then senator from Illinois. Douglas is best remembered for his debates with Lincoln. Stephen Douglas, could he have been the law school dropout? Clarence Darrow was a lawyer of world renown whose most famous case was the Scopes case, the so-called Scopes monkey trial of 1925. Could Clarence Darrow be a law school dropout? Robert Story was born in 1893. He served as president of the American Bar Association in 1952 and 53. Is he the law school dropout? Strom Thurmond was admitted to the bar in 1930. He later became governor of South Carolina and then senator from the state of South Carolina. Could he be the man we're looking for? Now remember, one of these distinguished gentlemen is a law school dropout. He abandoned law school after the first year, never to return. Was it one of the four chief justices of the Supreme Court? Was it Patrick Henry? William Wirt, Daniel Webster, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, or Strom Thurmond? All of the most famous lawyers in American history, these 12 men. One of them now was a law school dropout. All right, here's the answer. If you guessed Clarence Darrow was that dropout, you are right. Congratulations. You're right. Clarence Darrow, the one name that the whole world associates with the practice of law. He attended school for only 1 year. He never distinguished himself, and he dropped out of law school to study law on his own. Isn't that amazing? And he became one of the most famous lawyers in the world, a law school dropout. I was stunned when I saw that. Now, in concluding, we should also point out that the other 11 distinguished American lawyers. Remember these other 11: Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, William Wirt, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, Salmon P. Chase, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Robert Story, and Strom Thurmond could not have dropped out of law school. They could not have dropped out of law school. And that's because they never went to law school at all. Now, when I say that this whole concept of higher education or public school or high school diploma is associated with success, I would contend with you that that's an oxymoron. Boys and girls, we've only had 9 chief justices of the Supreme Court. 4 of them, it's almost half, you know, have been. Well, we might have had 10 now because we got a new one. His name is Judge Roberts. Chief Justice Roberts, we call him that. But 40% of them have never attended law school. Now, how in the hell can you become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court without ever having gone to law school? Boys and girls, education is not dependent upon some formal education. Education is, what do you know? What do you have between your ears? That's what counts. Let me tell you another story over here. There was a fellow one time. He was the head deacon. He was the chief deacon. They called him head deacon at that time. The head deacon of, what's the name of the, St. James. It was St. James Cathedral in London. And the head deacon here of St. James was illiterate. And he was 54 years old. This was about 1764, as I recall the date, 1764. He's the head deacon of St. James. He's been that head deacon. Well, he was a deacon for 30 years. And he was the head deacon for the last 10. So for 20 years, he had served as a deacon in the church. And this is the Church of England. And this St. James is a very famous, very big cathedral there in England, in London. And he's now the head deacon. I mean, he's the deacon of deacons. And he's illiterate. He can't read and write. And so one day, the rector, not the rectum, the rector, he comes out and he says, if, you know, we just got a new directive here, and if you can't read and write, if you're illiterate, you can't be a deacon in the Church of England. And so this poor guy is just devastated because he can't read and write. And so the bishop had sent down some instructions, said, we'll give you 6 months. If there's any deacons, you know, in the church that can't read, you know, you're just SOL. So anyway, this guy, he went home, he told his wife, he was just crestfallen, and he worked hard, and he tried to learn to read and write, but he couldn't. And 6 months went by. He came in, he still was just as illiterate as the day he was born. And so they terminated the poor guy. And so here he is, 54 years old, 1764. He's unemployed. He has just a little bit of savings, maybe a year's worth of savings. And remember, this is in the days, you know, before unemployment, Social Security. He just out of a job, he's just out of luck. So he had a little bit of savings, not very much, but a little bit. And his wife said to him, says, now listen, cheer up, you know, wake up. You know, tomorrow's the next day of the rest of your life. She said, you have always wanted to be a tobacconist. So why don't you go out and take our savings and why don't you open a store and start selling tobacco and tobacco supplies, because you have always enjoyed smoking yourself, and you've always enjoyed the various blends of tobaccos and one thing and another. And so maybe you could do that. And so he did. He went out and he bought some tobacco supplies, and he rented a little cubicle store in Piccadilly Circus, and there he was. He was a tobacconist, and surprisingly, he did pretty well. And he was able to support himself and his wife, and actually he made a little money at it. And the second year, he opened a second little tobacco store. And then the third year, he opened a third and a fourth. About 14 years later, he opens a new tobacco store every year. And 14 years later, now he's got 14 of these little tobacco stores, you know, scattered around London, England. So he still can't read and write. And one day he gets a letter from the bank. Now, remember, this guy can't read or write. So he takes the letter over to a friend, and he says, well, would you read this letter to me? And so he reads the letter, and the letter is pretty stern. And the letter comes from a bank official. And he says, sir, you have £235,000 on deposit with the Bank of England, and it is most improperly employed. And I would like to talk to you about the proper employment of your funds. and the poor guy was just devastated again. It's true, he did have 235,000 pounds in the bank, and that wasn't an issue. But to be told that it was most improperly employed was shocking, and he didn't really know how he was supposed to employ it, being, you know, incompetent. And, you know, we talk about people who can't read and write, and we think of them as being incompetent. Now, do you think this guy was really incompetent, or was it that he just wasn't formally educated? Well, anyway, he got up the courage, and so he went into the bank one day, and he sat down with the bank official in question, and the bank official pointed out to him that his money was employed at the paltry rate of 2% per annum on deposit, but his money could be much more productively employed if he were to invest it in stocks and bonds and other ventures over here, which would pay higher rates of interest and would more properly employ his money. And so the banker handed him some brochures from various companies and invited the head deacon from St. James here, the tobacconist now, to read these and see what he thought. So he's got these brochures, he's got these papers in his hand. Now he can't read and he can't write, you know. So he fidgets around a little bit, and so the banker sees that he's fidgeting around a little bit, and he said, well, sir. He hands them back to the banker, and he says, well, would you read these to me? Now the banker is absolutely shocked, and he said, pardon? You want me to read these to you? And he said, would you please? And he said, because I can't read. And the banker was just absolutely incredulous. Now you got to remember, 235,000 pounds, you know, back in 1760 and 70, you know, and 80, in those days, it was worth about $5 to a dollar. So, you know, 235,000 pounds was more than £1,000,000 in the bank. And you got to remember, back in those days, you know, a dollar was worth 10, 15 times what it is today. And this guy, you know, he's sitting here with 10 or 15 million bucks in the bank, which isn't, you know, a paltry sum even today, now is it? And the banker was so incredulous, he blurted out, he said, my God, man, can you imagine where you would be today if you could read and write? And our tobacconist said, yes, I would be the head deacon of St. James. Well, now, boys and girls, I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and we'll tell you some more. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. If you'd like more information, then we invite you to go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and that can all be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications used on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour editorial review. But these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, don't blame them, or the sponsors or management or staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about oxymorons. An oxymoron is where you come to a conclusion that if you do the same thing over and over again, you'll come to a different conclusion. Now, the Deacon of St. James is a true story of a real character who actually lived. Probably embellished a little bit, you know, for the trade, but I just thought I'd tell you the story of the Deacon of St. James, because here's a guy that's illiterate, and I've known a number of people that were illiterate that were great business successes. I mean, these people just had money coming out their earballs. Well, assuming that you call making money success. Now, from what I understand from the people who are telling me that I need to get an education, money is the primary motivation. I have never had anybody tell me that I need to be educated so that I would be a better person or that I would be more intelligent and could therefore be a better servant to my fellow man. I haven't experienced that. I imagine there might be two or three of you that might have. Now, there's another guy that wrote a book out here. I told you that I was going to tell you a few stories here. So, looking here on page 73 of David Barton's book, America to Pray or Not to Pray, taking a look at the educational quality of the students being turned down, he says an environment where violence, disrespect, and immorality prevails is not conducive to learning. And there have been such declines in students' knowledge of the basic academic facts that on March 17, 1986, U.S. Senator Bill Bradley moved to designate a Geography Awareness Week, a survey taken in January of that year, which had examined 5,000 high school seniors from eight major cities on their knowledge of basic geography, had precipitated his move. Here's the results. 25% of the students tested in Dallas, Texas, could not identify the country that borders the United States on the south. 39% of the students in Boston could not name the six New England states. 45% of those tested in Baltimore could not respond correctly to this instruction. On the attached map, shade in the area where the United States is located. Similar geographic weaknesses were discovered in a survey of college students conducted by the University of North Carolina in 1984. When college students were asked to identify the two largest states, fewer than half of them could name Texas and Alaska. Almost 80% could not name the two smallest states, Rhode Island and Delaware. Bradley concluded, "This news is frightening. We depend on a well-informed populace to maintain the democratic ideals which have made our country great. When 95% of some of our brightest college students cannot locate Vietnam on a world map, we must sound the alarm. We cannot expect to be a world leader if our populace doesn't even know who the rest of the world is. Basic historical knowledge appears to be at the same substandard level as basic geographical knowledge." A 1988 Department of Education book entitled American Education, Making It Work, concluded, quote, "Many students are unaware of prominent people and seminal ideas and events that have shaped our past and created our present." That statement resulted from a 1986 assessment of 17-year-old students, 80% of whom were enrolled in U.S. history classes at the time of this testing. So what were some of those problem areas? Well, almost half of these 17-year-old students could not place World War I between 1900 and 1950. More than two-thirds did not know when the Civil War took place. More than 75% were unable to say within 20 years as to when Abraham Lincoln was president. One-fifth of the students could not identify George Washington as the commander of the colonial forces during the Revolution. One-third did not know that Lincoln was the author of the Emancipation Proclamation. One-half failed to recognize Patrick Henry as the man who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." One-third did not know that the Declaration of Independence signaled the American colonists' break from England. And almost half could not say, even approximately, when the Constitution was written. Boys and girls, these people are not educated. Now, they may have diplomas. They may have letters. They may have placards that they put on the walls of their offices. But these people are fools, and they are totally uneducated. So the concept that you've got to have this diploma or this college degree with letters after your name is pure, unadulterated poppycock. Now, there's a famous case that comes out of Wisconsin. It's called Yoder versus Wisconsin. And it comes from the Amish. A fellow by the name of Jonas Yoder took his two children out of the public school in the eighth grade. Now, the state of Wisconsin came to the conclusion that children must be educated to at least the 10th grade or 16 years old. And so they prosecuted Mr. Yoder, the Amish man, because the Amish man believed, for whatever reason, God only knows why this guy was thinking this way, but he thought his children needed to get out of the public school and that they needed to come home to the farm and learn how to buck bales, milk cows, farm, drive horses, and do those things that are necessary and imperative in an Amish community in order to make a living. It was a wild concept on his part, to say the least. He did not believe that his daughters needed to learn how to get laid in the back of some kid's Chevy van by a pimply-faced punk, or that they needed to learn how to roll a marijuana cigarette with one hand or split lines of coke and snort dope. He didn't think that that was essential to these children's education. Now, we Americans believe that it is, and that's why we send them to public school. And most of the dope that is being transacted, bought, sold, and traded in the United States of America among high school, middle school, and grammar school children is being done on the public school grounds. Boys and girls, if you want your children to learn how to use drugs, public school is the place to send them. If you want your daughter to lose her virginity, if you want your daughter to be trained as a whore and your son to be trained as a sodomite, you cannot beat public school. Now, to get down to oxymorons, it's my position that learning how to split lines of coke, snort dope, roll marijuana cigarettes, become a whore or a sodomite is not education. I repeat, that is not education. Now, Yoder, coming to that conclusion, not having a high school or college diploma himself, jerks his kids out of public school, takes his case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state of Wisconsin came in their brief to the Supreme Court, and they said the reason that it's necessary and imperative that these children be educated in a school environment until they're 16 years old is that if they are not, they will not fit into society. They will be, they will become, they will end up as social misfits, unable to make a living. They will end up in prison. They will end up on welfare. They will end up in mental institutions if they are not educated in the public schools to be socially adapted to society. That was the state of Wisconsin's position. Now, the Amish guys, for their part, and to their credit, by the way, they came into the Supreme Court and they said, well, okay, we hear the state's argument. And the state is probably making a good argument. We wouldn't be here to tell you that Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, if they're not educated in the public school system, that they might end up on welfare, end up as prisoners in prison, or end up in mental hospitals. We can't speak for the majority of society. And maybe it's good for them, I don't know. But the Amish argued that it was bad for them, really bad for them. Bad for them on a number of grounds, and they pointed out, and then asked the question, and said, of the state's attorney general, said, well, since you're the expert in this field, how many Amish people do you have today locked up in the state's penitentiaries? And so they think about it for a while, and I want you to think about this, because, you know, there's a bunch of Amish out there in Pennsylvania. I mean, you Pennsylvanians over there have a whole bunch of these crazy misfits in your state. And you people in Ohio got another big batch of them, and hell, we got a bunch of them here in Missouri. I mean, these people are absolute misfits. They can't even dress intelligently. They don't have zippers. They don't use buttons. They don't have cars. They don't have driver's licenses. You talk about social misfits. I mean, a person without a driver's license, social security number? How on earth can these people live? How can they support themselves? Which was a good point that the state brought up. But when they asked the question, how many Amish people do you have locked up in the state's penitentiary, in the state of Wisconsin, after due diligence and after long searching, the answer was none. There wasn't a single Amish person locked up in the penitentiaries of Wisconsin. Well, you know, what's good for the goose is sauce for the gander. So they turned around and they said, well, how many people educated in the public school system have been locked up? How many of the prisoners that you have locked up in the penitentiaries of Wisconsin have been to public school? And the answer was all of them. Remember, our subject matter now is oxymoron. State of Wisconsin says if you don't educate these children until they're sophomores in high school, they'll end up being prisoners in jail. They took a look at the Amish and couldn't find a single Amish man in a state penitentiary. Couldn't find a single Amish man that had been educated in the public schools to age 16. Not a single one of them in the pen. But when they reversed it and said, well, how many people that are in the pen have been educated in public school? That means every one of them. So they asked the second question and said, well, how many Amish people do you have on welfare here in the state of Wisconsin? So they looked at the welfare rolls, and then they look at their religious affiliation, and they came to a conclusion. They couldn't find a single Amish. Not one Amish man on welfare, not one Amish woman, not one Amish child on welfare in the entire state. Remember what we're talking about here. Oxymorons. The state's position. If you don't educate these children in public school, at least till they're 16, they'll end up on welfare. What's good for the goose is sauce for the gander. So they reversed the question and said, well, of all the people that you've got in Wisconsin that are on welfare, how many of those people went to public school? And the answer was all of them. Every single one of them. Remember the subject matter? Oxymorons. State said, well, if these people don't go to public school, they'll end up as mental patients in the hospitals. So they took a look at the mental hospitals in Wisconsin. They couldn't find any Amish people in them. When you reverse the question, well, how many people in the mental hospital went to public school? The answer was all of them. So what's our conclusion? When you go to public school, you turn out to be crazy on welfare or in prison. No, that's not what we're claiming. I'm not sitting here telling you that if you go to public school, you're going to end up a prisoner in college. Or that if you don't go to public school until you're 16, you're going to end up on welfare. Or that if you don't go to public school until you're 16, you're going to end up in the mental hospital. I'm not making that claim at all. I'm just telling you that just because you don't go to public school until you're 16 doesn't mean you're going to end up in a mental hospital, in welfare, or in prison. Bottom line. And the Amish are on the face of the evidence of it. Hell, I imagine some of you Catholics, Protestants, and Jews could probably do the same thing with a little training. You know, I would suggest to you that we could probably learn a whole bunch from the Amish guys. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what those Amish guys are doing. But, you know, it looks like to me, if the goal of society is to prevent people from committing crimes and going to prison, we could probably learn a lot from a group of people that doesn't have a single one of their members in prison. I haven't got a clue as to what those Amish guys are doing. But I sure as hell wouldn't throw rocks at them. I sure as hell wouldn't say to the guy, well, you stupid moron, if you don't go to my school, you'll end up in prison. All the people that went to my school went to jail. Hell, I've been to jail several times. I don't deny it. I've never been on welfare. Oh, God, that's a damn lie. I've drawn unemployment insurance. I've been on welfare. I went to public school. Oh, no, I went to public school beyond the eighth grade. I've been in jail, and I've been on welfare. Public school does not prevent welfare recipients or welfare-itis or prison. Now, I haven't been to the mental hospital yet. I say yet. You know, you don't know what these clowns are going to do with the Patriot Act and Homeland Security and their terrorist designations. Hell, they may call me a crazy terrorist and lock me up like they do all these other people down Guantanamo. You know, it's always a possibility, isn't it? All right, so let's understand and let's learn a lesson over here as it relates to oxymorons. Let me tell you another story. Oh, Henry Ford. You ever heard that guy, Henry Ford, invented the Ford car? Well, oh, Henry, he went out and he built quite a little industrial empire. In 1913, there was a group of people, I forgot now exactly how this deal came down, but there was some litigation came about. Litigation. And part of the subject of the litigation was Henry Ford's inability to operate his company. And the allegation was made that because Henry Ford had only gone to the sixth grade, that he was incompetent and unable to manage such a large manufacturing or industrial enterprise, and that he needed to be taken out and replaced. It was 1913. Well, you know, Ford, you know, had invented this thing and put the thing together. He was a little bit put out by that, just kind of like you. You know, if I came over there and said, you know, you're incompetent, you can't handle your house, and I need to take it away from you and be appointed your guardian, you know, you might get a little bit bummed out and say, who the hell does this guy Gordon think he is anyway? Well, Henry, he was thinking the same thing. Now, who the hell do these people think they are? Well, Henry gets on the witness stand, and so on cross-examination, they came on and they ask him some questions like, well, now, Mr. Ford, isn't it a fact that you do not have a college education? And Ford said, yeah, that's right. Mr. Ford, isn't it a fact that you have never graduated even from high school? Ford said, yep, that's true. Well, Mr. Ford, isn't it a fact that you are not an industrial engineer? Ford said, yep, that's true too. And, Mr. Ford, isn't it a fact that you are not trained in accounting? And Ford said, yep, that's true too. They went down the list, you know, they're really after. You know, he wasn't an accountant. He wasn't an industrial engineer. And he hadn't been trained in college. And he didn't have any letters after his name. And he didn't graduate from high school. And he was just, you know, they just painted him out, you know, to be the biggest dumb fool that God ever put breath into. And now, Mr. Ford, just what makes you think that you're competent and qualified to handle this industrial enterprise? So Ford now asked the question. He said, well, here's the way I do that. You see, on my desk, I have 13 buttons. And each one of those buttons is hooked up by electrical connections to a bell. And each one of those bells is in an office. So when I have an accounting problem, and I need an accounting solution, I push button number 4, and my accountant, who is trained in college and has a degree in accounting, comes into my office, and I tell him what my problem is, and he gives me the answer. And when I have a design problem, I push button number 9, and I bring in an industrial engineer, and he comes in, and I tell him what my problem is, and he tells me what the answer is. And that's the way I run my company. Boys and girls, do you know that that's the way Bill Gates runs Microsoft? Do you know that that's the way Lee Iacocca ran Chrysler? Do you know that that's the way the President of the United States runs this country? Honest to God, do you think the President of the United States is an expert on education? What do you think that the Secretary of Education is there for? Do you think the President is an expert on state matters? Hell, our president can't even talk without grammatical errors, for crying out loud. He talks like a plumber. Maybe. Never plumbers that have better grammar and punctuation than our president. But we're talking about oxymorons here. Now, Henry Ford designed, built, and operated the Ford Motor Company. That seems like to me he did a pretty good job of it. It wasn't any of my business how he ran it. I don't know why these fools came in there and tried to make Ford look like a fool, but they did. And Ford kind of turned the tables on him. You know, he said, well, you know, maybe I don't know much about accounting, but, you know, I pushed the button. You know, boys and girls, I got a letter one time from Judge Clark up here at the federal courthouse. And Judge Clark wrote me a personal letter. He said, Mr. Gordon, he said, I want to commend you. I'd written a long brief. Is what it was, written a brief. And he'd read my brief, and he was evidently impressed with my brief. And he wrote me a letter. He said, Gordon, for a pro se litigant, I come in pro se. And he said, for pro se litigant, you write the best paper of any pro ses. And he said, if I may say, I believe that you write the best paper that is or has been submitted to this court. And I took that letter and I said, wow, look at this. Here's Judge Clark, federal district judge, writes me a letter, little Georgie Gordon. Says, you know, Gordon, you're a pretty smart guy. You write the best paper of any pro se. He said, if I may continue, he said, if I may add to that, he said, I think you probably write the best paper. Now, I want to tell you, boys and girls, when I sit here and write a brief, I write it on a yellow pad, and I sit here and write it in longhand. And it's full of punctuation and grammatical errors, you know. And my wife, she says, oh, my God, don't let anybody see you spell. And so after I get through writing this, it goes to my wife, and she edits it, and then it goes to my son, and then he edits it, and he puts it in the computer, and we put the spell checker on it, and pretty soon he puts it in the form over here, and it comes out of the computer. And then when this thing comes back to me, you know, it doesn't even look like anything that I wrote. But it tells the story that needs to be said. And it tells the story in the grammar and in the punctuation and in the verbs and the pronouns and the nouns and all those thingies that go together that make English. The judge reads that, and it's got my name on the bottom of it. But let me assure you, I did not write that final product. Now, you know, lawyers do the same thing. A lawyer writes, and the legal secretary fixes all of his mistakes, attaches the seals, attaches the ribbons, and you people think that it came right out of the lawyer's mouth. Well, let me tell you, it didn't come out of the lawyer's mouth. It came out of the legal secretary's education and experience. All right, we're out of time, kids. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. But meanwhile, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports every day, 7 days a week. We're out of time. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. Have good night, friends.